It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Israeli-Palestinian clash after possible revenge killing, and top diplomats agree to talks on new Ukraine ceasefire. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians are running high, fueling a possible revenge killing following the funeral of three kidnapped Jewish teens. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Israeli police fired tear gas at hundreds of stone-throwing Palestinians in an Arab suburb of Jerusalem. The clashes erupted after a Palestinian youth from the neighborhood was found dead. Residents say he was kidnapped outside a mosque and killed in revenge for the murder of three Israeli teenagers who were allegedly abducted by Palestinian militants. Police Commissioner Yochanan Danino urged the public not to draw conclusions and to act with restraint. Robert Berger, Jerusalem.
The foreign ministers of Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany say talks aimed at resuming a ceasefire between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian rebels should begin no later than Saturday. The diplomats, meeting Wednesday in Berlin, announced their consensus in a statement as fighting raged near the Russian border. They say the preliminary talks will establish an unconditional and mutually agreed sustainable ceasefire monitored by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. As delegates from Iran and six world powers arrive in Vienna for a marathon final round of talks, Iran says it is ready to take concrete steps to ensure its nuclear program remains peaceful, but will not kneel in submission. Speaking in a video message posted on YouTube, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif urged negotiators to use mutual respect in negotiations rather than what he called a spiral of escalation.
In the next 3 weeks, we have a unique opportunity to make history, to forge a comprehensive agreement over Iran's nuclear energy program, and to end an unnecessary crisis that has distracted us from addressing together our common challenges.
The parties face a July 20th deadline for a final agreement. U.S. prosecutors say the militant accused of carrying out the deadly 2012 attacks on American outpost at Benghazi, Libya, was motivated by his extreme anti-Western fervor. American authorities detailed some of their allegations against the suspect, Ahmed Abu Qatal, before a judge in Washington on Wednesday ordered him held in prison until his trial. He was captured last month by U.S. military commandos near Benghazi and is accused in the terrorist assault that killed U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three others. The increasingly deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa has regional health ministers meeting to discuss what their country's response should be. The World Health Organization, sponsor of the two-day event in Ghana's capital, says 467 people have died from the disease in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Dr. Peter Piot of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine says a massive information campaign is needed.
Fear of the virus and distrust of authorities and of the health system probably is as bad and as dangerous as the virus itself. And what I think is needed now is a massive information campaign, but not just facts, but involving community leaders, the media, the local media, more than disease experts.
The latest death toll released Tuesday represents a 38% jump since the agency's previous update a week ago. The death toll in the building collapse in the southern Indian city of Chennai has risen to 47 as hopes of finding any more survivors fade. More bodies were found Wednesday in the rubble of the 11-story building, which collapsed Saturday. Rescuers pulled 27 people out alive after the collapse. Police have arrested six construction company officials for alleged criminal negligence and violation of building codes. Officials continue to search for the cause of the collapse. And Hong Kong police say they have released the majority of about 500 protesters arrested overnight following a massive pro-democracy rally in the city that drew a crowd of about 500,000 people. I'm Bill Michaels in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Union representatives and employers in South Africa's latest strike will meet today to discuss possible solutions.
The purpose of that meeting is to still find a resolution, maybe settlement, and see what is possible from the employers to improve the offer to satisfy the workers.
Vuyo Lufele is Secretary General for the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, Western Cape Province. South Sudan's Information Minister responds to a report by Doctors Without Borders. A Uganda phone app lets citizens blow the whistle on corruption. And Sierra Leone's president and cabinet pledged 50% of their July salaries towards an Ebola fund as regional health ministers meet in Accra.
As you know, the Ebola virus is now a reality in Sierra Leone. In sympathy and empathy, the cabinet ministers made voluntary suggestions that they would be ready to forego 50% of their salaries for this month.
Alpha Kanu is Sierra Leone's information minister and providing a reliable and predictable power supply to Africa. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Africa's latest strike, called by the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, NUMSA, the country's largest labor union, enters its third day today, Thursday. The South African news agency says the strike may affect about 10,500 companies, including Eskom, which generates about 95% of South Africa's electricity supply. The workers are demanding a 12% wage increase, but some reports say the companies are offering as much as 8% in the first 12 months of the three-year agreement. Union members and representatives of companies affected by the strike are meeting today, Thursday, to figure out how to end the strike. Vuyo Lufele, Secretary General for NUMSA in the Western Cape Province, tells me the workers will not accept any increase less than 10%.
The purpose of that meeting is to still find a resolution, maybe settlement, and see what is possible from the employers to improve the offer to satisfy the workers. And then Friday, there will be another meeting between the two parties with the Department of Labor in trying to influence again what is the possible settlement in trying to stop economic challenges, because the strike will be hurting economy of the country.
I know the union is asking for 12%. What can you settle for? There are some reports that the employers may offer at least 8% to 10%.
If the employer offers 10%, which is a double digit, we will take to our members and check if they can consider accepting it. But we don't have a formal position about that. But we know that we always target double digits. But for now, we were given a mandate of 15%, and we moved from 15% to 12%. We know that not all our members are happy that we are at 12% now. But we will immediately consult with our members if employers move up to 10%. If they move to 10%, it will be worth considering.
According to some reports, there are threats being made by some of the employers, like Eskom, saying that the possibility of jobs loss. Is the union concerned about that?
Look, for us, we know that employers will always come with these tricks of job losses and so on and so on. And we always believe that we can't be blackmailed by these employers by indicating that, no, we are heading towards job losses if we are demanding what we are demanding.
I think it's the labor minister saying that this strike is going to have a major impact on the South African economy, and the government would not want it to happen. Do you think the government is coming in now very late?
No, I think they are still on time. It's not like what they did with the mine workers' strike, where they waited for 4 months before their intervention. I think they have learned a lot from that. They came on time now at the beginning of the strike, and they jump in because they know what would be the consequences. I think they are still on time, but they will have to influence business, because it won't be labor that is causing a collapse of the economy of the country. Because we think that we have got legitimate demands that we have placed before employers, and they can afford that. Now, government must influence and ensure that employers bring forward an offer that can improve workers' working conditions and benefits and wages.
Vuyo Lufele is the Secretary General for NUMSA Western Cape Province. He was speaking with me from Cape Town. Health ministers from across West Africa were attending an emergency conference in Accra, Ghana, to discuss the regional outbreak of Ebola. The World Health Organization says the highly infectious disease has killed more than 400 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Henry Richwell reports for VOA from London.
Police and medical workers man checkpoints on the outskirts of Kanema in Sierra Leone, the site of an Ebola outbreak that is spreading across West Africa. Authorities are forcing people to test for the disease. Some victims try to avoid detection, preferring to die in secret. The outbreak is the worst since the disease was identified in the 1970s, says Peter Pyatt, director of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
The outbreak in West Africa is unprecedented in the history of Ebola outbreaks because it involves three countries at least, capital cities, multiple sources, and that will make it far more difficult to control.
Ebola causes fever, vomiting, bleeding and diarrhea. It is spread through contact with the blood or other fluids of infected people. Doctors say a lack of understanding is contributing to its rapid spread. Porous borders between the affected countries make it difficult to contain. Families often bury victims in secret, says Dr. Sheikh Moa Khan of Kanema Government Hospital in Sierra Leone.
By the time people are dead with the Ebola, they are more infectious than all. So if they take care of their burial or their own, 10 more will be infected.
In neighbouring Liberia, nurse Elizabeth Smith lies bleeding on a hospital bed. She contracted the Ebola virus from her patients. Her colleagues are doing what they can to help, but her chances of survival are about 10%. District Health Officer Philip Azuma says Liberia cannot cope alone.
We are calling on the international community to come and support the ministry. Right now, we can't do it now. We need the international support.
But it's not just medical help that's needed. Communities across the region need urgent education about the disease, says Peter Pyatt.
Fear of the virus and distrust of authorities and of the health system probably is as bad and as dangerous as the virus itself. And what I think is needed now is a massive information campaign, but not just facts, but involving community leaders, the media, the local media, more than disease experts.
Health workers bury the dead in unmarked graves in the middle of the bush. The disease is so infectious that disinfectant is sprayed every step of the way. The workers' protective clothing is buried along with the body. The death toll from the outbreak is growing. Doctors warn the response has so far been far from adequate. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma and his cabinet ministers on Wednesday pledged 50% of their July salaries towards an Ebola fund to help with the logistics needed to contain the spread of the virus. Minister of Information Alpha Kanu tells Odette Frazier, the cabinet ministers made their offer out of empathy for the people of Sierra Leone who are directly affected by the virus.
As you know, the Ebola virus is now a reality in Sierra Leone, although, in fact, it is still contained in only the easternmost districts of Kailangu and Kenema. But the president has now taken the head of the fight now, and he is making all arrangements and all interventions to try and prevent the spread and also try and mitigate the suffering of those who have already been infected. In sympathy and empathy, the cabinet ministers made voluntary suggestion that they would be ready to forego 50% of their salaries for this month. And, of course, the president and the vice president also followed suit.
Is it safe to say that the donor support by the World Health Organization or Medicines Sans Frontières, etc., is just not enough and therefore a separate Ebola fund had to be created? Or is this just for show?
No, not that. We know that we cannot even quantify how much money will be needed for the fight because, as you know, this is a new virus in the region. This is a virus that is alien to West Africa. It was known to be in Central Africa. How it came here, nobody knows. However, the fund that has been put together by the international donor community has been commendable. They are doing their best in terms of finances, materials, logistical support, and in terms of physical and intellectual support to the teams here. We just believe that everybody has a duty to show that we are all in this together. The people are affected in the remote areas of Konoha and Kerema, but we cannot tell when it will go into other districts.
Critics are saying that this gesture is not the answer, as the government needs to put together a comprehensive plan to fight the virus and also improve on the general living conditions of the people. How would you react to that?
I don't think the Ebola virus, when it broke into America in 1989 and 1990, it was due to low living conditions. No, that's far from it. I think this is just a virus. This is just an epidemic. So this is the reason the same reason it is here now in West Africa. I don't think it is reflective of the poor living conditions of the people. No, it is just a virus that comes and goes. These things are cyclic. It just happens that it is West Africa's turn now. It is no show. It is definitely a disease that government is working hard to reduce, to mitigate, and definitely we have plans. The plans are on, they've been rolled out. We're working on those plans, but the plans need to be supported. So money has to be put there for plans to work.
Alpha Kanu is Sierra Leone's information minister. He was speaking with Odette Frazier from Freetown, Sierra Leone. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Thursday, July 3rd. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's Minister of Information says rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar are responsible for much of the atrocities that took place during that country's now six-month-long conflict. Michael McQuay was reacting to a report this week by the international charity group Doctors Without Borders. The group said South Sudan's fragile healthcare system has been destroyed in parts of the country affected by the conflict. But McQuay tells me that South Sudan government forces are disciplined and could not have committed such atrocities.
Well, of course, I thought it was a new incident that took place. But if they are reporting on the past for the last 6 months, then definitely this is what the rebel did in Bor, this is what they did in Malakal, this is what they did in Unity State in Bantio.
So you are saying that the government in Juba or your forces did not commit any of these atrocities they are talking about?
The government forces are disciplined forces. They have not destroyed any property. They have not destroyed any hospital. They have not killed anybody in the hospital. These are atrocities which were committed by the rebels and which were witnessed by some other organizations. I don't know. This Medecins Sans Frontières, where have they been all this time to come and report at this time on the atrocities which were committed by the rebels in January and February and March?
So, Mr. Minister, where are we? Where are you? And you, I mean, when I say you, I mean the South Sudan government and the rebels of former Vice President Riek Machar. Where are you in the peace process?
Well, the peace process, of course, we could not proceed after the agreement of the two leaders. But we must conclude our agreement within 60 days from the 10th of June. Unfortunately, the rebels decided to reject the participation of all the stakeholders, and as such, they boycotted the meeting.
According to what we know, that the civil society that your government would like to participate were people who are sympathetic to the government in Juba.
Well, that is the position of the rebels. The rebels are saying that it is not the civil society only, but all the stakeholders. The civil society is one of the stakeholders. The stakeholders are the civil society, the faith-based organizations, the political parties, and the former SPLM detainees. These are the four stakeholders plus the two, which are the government and the rebels, six. These are the six stakeholders who were supposed to sit in a multi-stakeholder dialogue whereby we would be sitting to negotiate all the issues and discuss all the issues of concern. This came as a result of a demand by the rebels that for us to proceed, all the stakeholders must be represented. And it is IGAD, not the government of South Sudan. It is IGAD which selected all these stakeholders.
Michael Makwi is South Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Ugandan anti-corruption groups are testing a telephone application for citizens to check the amount of money their government spends on schools and health clinics and report when that money is not used for the right purposes. As Hillary Hewler reports for VOA from Kampala, the app hopes to drive home the local effects of corruption and gets citizens involved.
Until recently, spotting corruption in Uganda required intimate knowledge of a public institution's finances. But now, in theory at least, you need nothing more than an internet connection. Action for Transparency is an app developed by Ugandan civil society groups to show citizens how much money schools and health centers are allocated, and for what. When people see signs the money isn't being spent for its intended purpose, all they need to do is click on an icon that says whistle. Gerald Businge works with the Uganda Media Development Foundation and is responsible for managing the app. He says it gives anyone in Uganda the opportunity to anonymously blow the whistle when funds go missing.
If, for example, money was for buying medicine and medicine not available and they know that actually the money came, then they can be able to report that at this health center there's no medicine. They can whistleblow on any school, on any health center. And then one of our partners, Transparency International, is able to follow up that report.
Having the eyes of the public upon them should stop many officials from stealing money, says Businge. It will also help catch corruption earlier, making money easier to track down. But Businge points out that corruption isn't the only problem with Uganda's public institutions. Schools and health clinics are embracing the project, he says, because it will show the public how poorly funded they really are.
Because there is so much rampant corruption, people think money is being stolen even when it's not being stolen. They think like they will get a chance for people to know how much is allocated to them and how little actually it is.
Uganda is regularly rocked by corruption scandals at all levels of government, and Transparency International ranks the country as among the most corrupt in East Africa. For the moment, Action for Transparency is only available for institutions in and around Kampala, but Businge says there are plans to eventually expand upcountry. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
It is estimated that 550 million people in Africa do not have access to electricity. This motivated Princeton Power Systems to partner with a U.S.-based technology company to create Africa's largest self-sufficient solar microgrid off the coast of Equatorial Guinea. Darren Hamel, co-founder of Princeton Power Systems, tells reporter Peter Clotty that his company is working with the government of Equatorial Guinea and many African countries to implement similar solar power generation plants.
Several companies came together, including General Electric. They're making an advanced set of batteries for the system. Macy is providing the overall project development. And Wise Power Systems is providing the construction piece on the island and the solar array. And then Princeton Power is providing all of the electronics technology that ties all those components together and does the power conversions to create the AC microgrid.
So if I may ask you, apart from this island, will your company also partner other U.S. companies to provide this kind of solar energy to other African countries?
Absolutely. Yeah, and we currently have a couple of projects going in Kenya and Nigeria, and we've been looking at a few projects in South Africa, and we think there's a very big market for these types of systems, especially now that solar's less expensive and batteries have gotten much better performing and also less expensive.
How are you being embraced in these African countries, especially when they have an abundance of sun rays in their countries?
Well, I think there's a great need for this kind of technology. As you said, in places with a lot of sunlight, it can be very economic, very cost-effective. So I think there's a great desire to get this technology into Africa. Some of the challenges are financing systems like this. Oftentimes, the country or the local businesses will have trouble getting the capital costs together to install a system like this. And so that's one of the challenges that a bunch of different groups are trying to work through to get private capital into Africa to deploy these kinds of systems.
Darren Hamo is co-founder of Princeton Power Systems. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotte from the U.S. state of New York. Twenty-five minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Olmai, Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Algerian goalkeeper Rice Mboli reckons they have left an indelible mark on Algeria's football history despite their 2-1 loss to Germany in extra time in Porto Alegre on Tuesday. Moments after receiving the Man of the Match award from their tie against Germany, the Algerian custodian credits coach Vahid Halihotzig for guiding them beyond the group phase for the first time in Algerian history. Meanwhile, the Algerian Desert Fox arrived back home in Algiers to a rapturous reception from ordinary members of the public to the Algerian Prime Minister Abdelmalek Celal on Wednesday. Throughout the team's journey on the streets of Algiers, fans chanted praise to Algeria's coach Vahid Halihotzig. Social media in Algeria is abuzz with calls for the Bosnian tactician to be retained. His contract with the federation was only up to the end of the Algerian World Cup campaign. Elsewhere, Ghana Football Association President Kwesi Nyantigi says they will retain the services of the Black Stars coach Kwesi Appiah. Upon arrival in Accra from Brazil, Nyantigi disclosed that the GFA executive gave Appiah the thumbs up for his stewardship of the team. Nyantigi also apologized to the Ghanaian public for the team's early exit at the World Cup. He recognizes that Ghanaians expected to build on the quarterfinal appearance of 4 years ago. Staying in Accra, Ghana Black Stars players will be required to sign a code of conduct before any future competitions, the Ghana Black Stars coach Kwesi Appiah revealed in Accra on Wednesday. The long overdue code of conduct should go some way to curb acts of indiscipline by some players at critical moments in Ghana's future campaigns, not just at the World Cup but also at the Orange Africa Cup of Nations. Finally, Nigerian coach Stephen Keshi refutes claims that he has resigned from coaching the African champions. Keshi told the media in Brazil that his contract was until the end of the World Cup campaign in Brazil. Beyond that, he will engage with his employers, the Nigeria Football Federation, on the way forward. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Thursday morning, July 3rd.
I wish to announce to the whole world that the judgments of God have already begun with the Boko Haram, who are now facing the mysterious snakes and wildest killing in their hideout in the forest of Borno State. And if they do not repent and return, those kidnapped with immediate alacrity, the judgment shall rise to the point of bringing the lions of Elisha of old to attack the bull. Let the Christian continue to pray. Prince John Michel Obanikwu in Obudu Ranch Resource, Crossover, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The increasingly deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa has regional health ministers meeting to discuss what their country's response should be. And the United Nations World Food Program is reducing food aid to nearly 800,000 refugees in Africa. That's it for this Thursday, July 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Schrag, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good Thursday.
Love African music?
Music Time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.